Hello, I'm very glad to welcome you to the second of this year's Jane Jacobs Lectures, being given by Joseph Rickword. May I say again how much I regret the difficulty of our first meeting. I particularly regret it because the final one of these lectures is going to be in the same impossible hall where we began last week. That is the new lecture theater at the LSE. I think these are merely floating signifiers. This doesn't look very new to me, but the scheduling masters who have control of us have given us this only for this evening. As I told you last week, these lectures are in honor of the writer who probably single-handedly made us confront issues of the relationship between architectural design, social use, the needs of communities, the relation between aesthetics and everyday experience. This is Jane Jacobs. And there is no one who, in my view, is more fitting inaugural lecture in this, Joseph Rickword, who as an academic has tried to prove the relationship between architectural design and anthropology in particular, which forms the subject of these three lectures. As I said when we first met last week, what I'd like Joseph to do is complete the set of three lectures. And then, once the argument is unfolded to us next week, in its full glory and splendor, at that point to arrange for a discussion with those of you who have followed the lectures themselves. We have a presentation tonight. We'll meet again next week, followed by as much discussion as you like, and the odd glass of white wine appearance at the end of next week as well. Finally, can I suggest for the three of you who are sitting here that you'll see much better side. The LSE is not very visually orientated, as you can tell. The notion is that the lone voice of truth speaks out without having to be seen. So let me introduce Joseph Rickword again to you tonight, who is going to speak this evening on Renaissance and Baroque period in urbanism. Thank you very much.
Okay, so you have everything here.
This is the microphone.
Yeah. I'm going to sit down.
Very good. Renaissance and Baroque. Perhaps I should start off by saying that about 20 years ago or more, is that better? Well, then maybe I should have the other mic. I have to lean forward like that.
Hold on. I'm going to solve this problem. I'm not going to solve this problem.
No.
Can you lean slightly closer to it?
I think we have this one.
And
yeah.
But does it work?
You can see how technically oriented we are.
Can you hear now? Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Yes. I started off with a doubt about the title of my lecture as far as Richard Serra's presentation goes, because many, many years ago, 20 or more, I gave a course of lectures on Roman architecture in the 17th century. And at the end of the last one of the students came up to me and said, "But Joseph, aren't all these buildings Baroque?" And I thought for a moment, and I said, "Well, yes, if you like." He said, "You haven't used the word." And I must say, I was very proud of myself. So Baroque is something I have problems with, and I even have some problems with Renaissance, though I think I'm clearer in my mind about what that might mean. But I want to start today really by recapitulating what I went on about last week. If you remember, I spoke about the notion of the archetype as Jung and Kereny defined it, particularly the archetype of which I spoke, that is, the squaring of the circle. And Jung and Kereny considered it so profoundly rooted in the human mind that they decided that it must have a biological root and that it must be based on that elemental experience of all living beings, the division of the fertilized cell. But I take my stand on a rather different point of departure. If I can take my stand on it, yes, I think I can. And I'd like to quote a biologist called Peter Wilson, who, writing some years ago, said, "Once the species Homo sapiens emerges, human evolution becomes a story of the development of culture." And I think that is really where I would like to start considering the problem of what happens to that archetype in a cultural context, which I'm going to discuss. The archetype which relates to the sense of me in the world, which begins when you become aware of yourself standing at right angles to the ground and looking before you and aware that there is something behind you and knowing your left from your right. It certainly is a very early consciousness, though we have no way of knowing when the genus Homo arrived at it, nor have we any way of knowing what the mechanism was which led to it. But it is part of that development which is also the development of the ability to symbolize, the ability to see that one thing means can mean something else, the ability to make metaphor, which is, of course, the condition of language. And so perhaps I'll start at once with the images. Can we have the lights down and the first two images? And again, they are reminders. On your right, you have that image which looks superficially Christian, but is in fact an illustration of the Roman Surveyor's Manual, which illustrates the notion of man in a circle in which he is looking outward, he's looking in fact that way, and which the left and the right dictate the squaring of the circle, and which is that quadrature, that squaring, is the basic schema of the Roman city plan. And I spoke at some length about the way in which Romulus constituted Rome on the Palatine Hill. This is the Palatine Hill in the development plan of Rome of 1883. So you see, all this is still empty space. But this is, in fact, the original Rome. And I noted that the first Rome, there was no reason to believe that the first Rome was in fact square, as many archaeologists in the 19th century believed, and this led them to very awkward excavations trying to find the original square walls of Rome, which of course never existed. Let's have the next one there, please. And I noted also the persistence of this image in this, these are examples of Neolithic pottery from various sites in the Near East. And you see how much, how this original idea of this of this, the squaring of the circle, as I've called it, really the division of the circle by four, persists in this kind of pottery and persists in all sorts of projects and handicrafts from all over the world. And it relates, next one there, please, to the way in which the Romans considered their habitable space. This is the division of the horizon that goes back, of course, to that diagram which I showed you. This is the way in which the Roman augurs divided space. They stood at the north end of the axis which they were about to make. They named something long, a long way in front of them, which was the end point of their horizon, and they named trees or buildings to the left and to the right, and this divided the world into fortunate and unfortunate, favorable and unfavorable sides, and then the procedure was very complicated. I won't go into it, but you see how this is constantly reiterated in Roman practice. I think we should remember that the Roman augurs practiced their augury every day in Rome. It was a state function. And they had a site on the Capitol Hill from which they could look out in the way they did. And we know more about it than perhaps about other things, about other Roman practices, because there was a law case in the 2nd century AD when a landowner, a developer, was told that he had to pull down the top stories of a building because they were obstructing the augur's view of the horizon. Before doing so, he sold it to an unfortunately innocent purchaser, who was then told that that he had to do this knocking down. And this is, of course, where caveat emptor applies. He didn't know, but he still had to spend the money on the knocking down. Unfortunate, but it's an interesting case, and it shows us the power of these strange figures, who were not taken very seriously sometimes by Roman intellectuals. In fact, Cicero remarks at one point that he doesn't know how two augurs on meeting can't stop laughing. Next one there, please. So, the grid with which we are so familiar goes back to these strange and arcane things, and it doesn't go, it's in a way, to look at it in Rome, to look at it in the ancient world. It is more illuminating to go back to these rather archaic and remote practices than to compare it to the sort of grid that we are used to. And this is, of course, New York in the 1840s, 1850s. Next one, please. The other thing that the other ceremony to which I referred was the business of plowing round the site, making a boundary. And this is a coin. Quite often, coins were struck to commemorate these events. This is a coin struck by the Emperor Commodus, a very disagreeable character. One of the great historians of Rome says that he ends the period of enlightened despotism. He had himself worshipped as Hercules, and you see him dressed in the lion's head of Hercules, and he's plowing, doing the ceremony of plowing, with wearing the Hercules outfit. Now, he reigned about 180, 190 AD. But long before him, these, next one there, please. These coins were produced all over the ancient world. Each one of these commemorates one of these plowing ceremonies. They come from, this is from Beirut, this is from a small town near Saragossa in on the Ebro in Spain, and these are both from Saragossa. The two bottom ones are quite close in time. That one's Claudius, and that one is of Caligula. So this one is late Republican, it's about the earliest one. So this is a ceremony which was performed quite routinely. It was one of the privileges of a Roman emperor who'd extended the boundaries of empire to perform the ceremony, extend the boundaries of the city. And as I said last week, Caligula is one of them. Emperors who didn't quite manage to do that carried out the ceremony in order to claim that particular advantage. Next one, please. Now, in fact, Romulus founded the original city on the Palatine Mound, but it was really very small. And this, the capital, where in fact the Auguraculum was, where the August read the future, was a rival city, a rival settlement of people called Sabines. They're also Latin-speaking Italiots. And some of you may remember the legend that Romulus's followers, short of women, stole those of the Sabines, and it came to a fight in which the women intervened and made peace. And that is when the city was extended, and between the Sabine town and the Latin town, there formed a space, a public space, which is called Forum. You see it here. And we are so used to the idea that the Forum is the center of the city, is the central space, that we tend to forget that Forum is really outside. Forum comes from foris, which means abroad or outside, and we get a word foreign from the same root as forum. And the same thing happens in Greek. Let's have the next one there, please. These are the buildings that, the sort of buildings that you might have expected to find on the Palatine of Romulus. So the idea of forum is actually related also to the idea of agora. We use the words interchangeably, and they are in fact related philologically, because agora comes from agros, outside, wide field, and the whole notion of the forum as the center is really alien to the way in which the word was formed. The idea is that that somehow it's a space left over, it's a space. Let's have the next one here, please. The Sabines were there, the Romans were there. There is the Roman Forum. There are the rostra. Next one there, please. From which the speeches were made. That's the arch of Septimus Severus. It'll come up again in a moment. That's it. The rostra were to this side. Can you leave that? That's the temple of the divine Julius Caesar, where the pyre stood. And behind it is the ancient nucleus of the forum, the house of the king, Regia, the house of Numa Pompilius, the first Sabine king of Rome, and next to it, the sanctuary of Vesta, the goddess of fire, and there is the house of the Vestal Virgins. But these are the essential elements of the forum, and by it is the Curia, the place where the Senate met. Next one there, please. But this is the equivalent Greek instance of the making of a public space out of the leftovers. Because what you see happens here, this is an interesting case. It's a settlement, a very early Greek settlement in Sicily, Megarae Blaea. It was founded about 730 BC and abandoned about 300 BC when the aristocracy was moved to Syracuse and the plebeians were sold into slavery. But you see, what you have here is two grids meeting, and left out of the grids is a space which makes the synoikia, which makes the coming together of peoples. And that is, I think, a sort of essential element of urban life, that it always, in a way, the word polis is sometimes used as a synonym of synoikia, a synonym of coming together. The idea of the forum as the center of a unified space is alien to the way the city is made. And I think that's a point that's worth remembering. Now, the Forum of Rome was, of course, where all roads lead, and there was here the point from which measurements were taken, from which milestones were counted. So this is a point of confluence, and Rome becomes a world city, so that Rome is imitated all over the world, imitated through the ceremonies, imitated through the way the plan is made. Next one there, please. Sorry, I was going to talk about something else. On the forum in Rome, and this happens also in Greek cities, there is an element of a foundation deposit. What you have here is a photograph taken when it was first excavated of this little piece of dark stone there. It's called lapis niger, the black stone. And underneath it, next one there, please. When the stone was lifted, this was found. Now, there are various elements. There's a sippus. There is a little altar. There is a tomb, which was known as the tomb of Ropinus for various reasons. And there's also a rather curious element. Can you get it slightly more in focus? I'm afraid it's not very much clearer, but this is probably the most ancient Roman inscriptions in Latin. It's a Bustafidian inscription, that is, it goes backwards and forwards like that. And it seems to be, it's not easy to understand, it seems to be an order to clear the sacred way clear of cow droppings, bull ox droppings. Not a very exalted text, but it is, as I say, the earliest Latin text. And this is a deposit which was obviously counted by the Romans as a sacred space. It was put in front of where the Senate met. And it became a kind of place which related the city to the ground in a way in which a number of places in the city had to be used, had to be read as the gates to hell. One of the great historians of Rome said that the whole city, the whole ground of the city of Rome, was pierced everywhere with hell mouths, because that's where the dead would come up. And this is one of these places. But at the center of Rome, probably somewhere on the Palatine, there was a space called Mundus. Mundus means the world, but it also means order, like the Greek word cosmos. And it's a three-tiered space in which certain ceremonies were carried out. And in a sense, the Lapis Niger is another one of those spaces, places where the relationship between the city and the ground is consecrated. Next one there, please. The bit we've been looking at is here. That's the Temple of the Divine Julius. There is the Regia, and the Temple of Vesta is not visible, it's just here. And there is the Senate House. So the Lapis Niger is this spot here. But you see beyond that, the fora stretched in an enormous extent. It was probably the biggest paved public space in the world. May still be the biggest pedestrian space in the world. And the accretion was slow. This was built by Augustus as the Forum of Julius Caesar, started by Julius Caesar, with a temple of Venus as the ancestor of the family. This was a temple to the revenge on Caesar's murders, Temple of Mars Ultor, and then the Emperor Trajan built himself this huge forum with the largest of the basilicas and a column which survives and a temple behind. Now, perhaps I should just say that the excavations over the last few years have disposed of the second apse. And we no longer think that the statue was there, but stood somewhere in the corner. But apart from that, the whole development of that space is basically connected. It was a huge area. Next one there, please. And there you have a reconstruction. So you're looking to identify the places. This is the Regia, tiny building here. But the Temple of Vesta is there. The Arch of Septimus Severus, which we've seen before, the Curia, and then beyond that, stretch the Imperial Fora well away, and this is the Capitol Hill. So you have the Sabine Capitol Hill, and you have the Fora stretching that way. Now, this kind of space required a vast economy to support it. And I think it's worth remembering that Rome was always a consumer city and not a producer city. It grew to an absolutely huge size. About 200 AD, the Roman population counted about 2 million. There's no agreement about the exact population because we don't know the number of high-rises, we don't know how high they went. But there were a number of high-rises, 8, 9, 10-story buildings all over Rome and in some of the provincial towns as well. But after 200 and after the Emperor Commodus, whom I mentioned before, there comes a strange hiatus. The Roman population outgrows itself. Between 235 and 285, there are 26 emperors, which gives them an average of 2 years' reign. Taxation has to be raised very severely to feed both the army and the games, and finance the games, as well as maintain these enormous buildings. Meanwhile, because to finance this, coin alloy had to be debased, there's very considerable inflation. and rivals appear. The Goths and Sarmatians attack Gaul. The Sasanian dynasty rises in Persia. And one of the emperors, Valerian, is actually captured by the Persians, which the Persians proudly record in their great reliefs of the Persian kings. Rome feels threatened. Next one there, please. And the towns which depend on it are beginning to feel that things are not secure. They are, writers on architecture tend to speak of these towns as being designed by Roman engineers and being in some ways produced by Roman artists and craftsmen. This is not true. The pervasiveness of the Roman model was extremely powerful, and it needed no artists and craftsmen to travel and diffuse it. Can we go back to the previous one now? This is, of course, a tiny imitation of that. This is a form of Pompeii. It's still in Italy, it's in the south, it's south of Naples, so as you probably know, it all is covered over by Vesuvius, but you see a temple rather like that. The way it relates to the volume is very much in the same way as it relates here. There's another subsidiary temple. It's surrounded by markets and meeting chambers and even a basilica. So it has the elements of the Roman Forum. Next one there, please. And the next one there. And there, please. Now, when Rome feels threatened, the wall is rebuilt. Rome had several walls. This is the so-called square wall of Romulus. This is the wall built by one of the last Etruscan kings, Servius Tullius, which divides Rome, which encloses the Rome, of course, of four regions, before it was divided into 14. And then the Emperor Aurelian builds the wall, which still exists, which is still intact. And then it crosses over the Tiber here and goes on like that. I'd like you to point out this to you, because that is, again, a squared space. It's the camp of the Praetorian Guard, who are going to cause a great deal of trouble to Rome. But towards the end of the 3rd century, another curious figure arises, the Emperor Domitian, who... Diocletian, who becomes emperor in 284. He is a simple soldier who has risen through the ranks and decides towards the end of his life that he will retire. He abdicates in 305 and builds himself a space not unlike the original Roman town, rectangular Roman town, squared, and the Praetorian camp. He builds himself near his hometown, Salona, a palace in which the main chambers are on the sea coast, face the sea. There's a great entry hall, a presence chamber, and it also includes a huge mausoleum for himself, facing a temple, which is now the cathedral of the town of Split. Next one there, please. It's one of those cases where the palace has been entirely occupied by a new town. Salona fell to pieces, and the people from Salona settled inside the enclosure of Diocletian. But he also made another decision. Next one there, please. he divided the administration of the empire between four emperors. Two were called Augusti and two were called Caesars. This is a relief of the four emperors, probably 4th century, Porphyry, perhaps from Egypt. It's by the Porta della Carta in by the Doge's Palace, of the Doge's Palace in Venice. In Venice it's called the Four Moors. They are thought to be, the Venetians take them to be four Saracens who wanted to steal the body of St. Mark. But they are, in fact, the four Tetrarchs. And they didn't live in Rome. Domitian still, to some extent, used Rome as his residence place. But the Tetrarchs lived everywhere. York, Trier, Paris, Milan, Aquileia, Damascus, Nicomedia, and so on. So they spread all over the empire. The authority of the emperor was diffused. And although very soon after Diocletian died, one of his successors reunified the empire, he too had rather curious ideas about what to do with Rome itself. Next one there, please. And there. He defeated one of his rivals, Maxentius, in 312, and claimed to have done so having seen a vision of the cross. He became a Christian, certainly in name. There's some disagreement when he was actually baptized, probably on his deathbed, but he certainly became a protector of Christians and decided to impose the pattern of Christianity on the ancient capital. There was a great deal of opposition, pagan opposition in Rome. So in fact, he put the main churches inside the city walls, on the edge, on imperial property, the Church of St. John Lateran, which became the Cathedral of Rome, and the Church of the Holy Cross, which was the palace chapel. The other main churches were put outside the walls, the basilicas. St. Peter's on the Vatican, which was not inside the Aurelian Wall, St. Paul's on the Ostian Way, St. Lawrence here, and these were connected by funerary ways. The Romans liked to use their ways as their roadways, as a kind of cemetery. So they were also related to cemeteries. But the emperor himself moved to the new Rome, Constantinopolis, Nova Roma, on the Bosphorus. It was near Troy. That was one of its great attractions. And he moved to it according to the Etruscan rite. We know that he plowed the furrow, that the date was registered according to the Olympiads, that he carried it out on a day which was fortunately calculated by his astrologers, when the sun was in Sagittarius and the hour was dominated by the crab. And we know that whilst he was plowing, he left the route marked out by his diviners and his surveyors. And when his followers asked him why he did so, he said that he was following his leader, and we still don't know who the leader was, whether it was an angel or whether he's actually suggesting that it was Christ himself. But at any rate, he was following some supernatural entity which led him to enclose Constantinople in this divinely protected wall. Next one there, please. But Rome was left to the Pope. This is a quite late cycle of frescoes of San Sylvester, the Pope, wearing tiara, which a Persian type of tiara, which Constantine is supposed to have given him, having his white horse led by the emperor. This was painted in the 12th century and reflects the curious imbalance of power that resulted from this decision. Constantinople became the emperor's town, and Rome became the pope's town. The emperor, the Western Empire, fell to pieces, as you probably will know, under the pressure of the Goths and there's other invaders. And the West was deprived of central authority. The only emperor reigned from Constantinople. But in the year 800, Pope Leo III crowned a Frankish leader, Charles, as emperor in St. Peter's. And from then on, from then until the 15th century, the custom was that the Pope crowned the emperor in Rome. And the dialectic between the papacy and the empire became one of the themes of medieval history. It was an uneasy relationship at all times. Quite often, the journey of the emperor to be crowned in Rome became a military campaign. And until the Reformation, this rite was carried on, sometimes in a bloody way, but always concentrating on the curious status of Rome as the place to which all roads led. In 1300, Pope Boniface VIII proclaimed the Holy Year, the first one. And from then on, this was a kind of pilgrimage thing which, in which all Europe took part. People went down to Rome, and Rome became infested also with diseases. It was because it was terribly badly sanitized, it was very uncomfortable, and remember that the population by then was still dropping. In 1350, Europe was stricken by the Black Death. It was again a holy year, and the results in Rome were pretty disastrous. But by then, the popes had moved to Avignon. In 1308, Clement V moved to Avignon, and for 70 years, the popes were what was called the Babylonian captivity. There were various attempts to recreate the grandeur of Rome. In just before the Black Death, a Roman lawyer, Cola di Rienzo, declared himself tribune of the people and decided that the emperor was dependent not on the pope and not on the coronation, but on the will of the Roman people. It had strange, interesting ramifications. Petrarch became his main advocate, and he unfortunately overreached himself and was murdered by the Roman populace on the Capitol in 1354. After 1350, the population of Rome had sunk, remember, from 2 million, about, to 17,000. And this is one of the curious things about Rome, that it is one of the few world cities which becomes world city twice over. It's a world city as the city of the empire. It then loses a status. It becomes a kind of religious center under the papacy. And then it becomes a world city between about 1450 and 1700. So it's really this which I want to conclude with. Because Rome, as a ruin, became an object of admiration and literary as well as emotional what shall I call it? Literary activity and emotional outpourings. The weeping over the ruins of Rome was a kind of literary trope. Perhaps the most famous one is a poem called The Ruins of Rome, which a French poet, Joachim de Bellay, wrote in about 1550. And sometime afterwards, it was translated into English by Edmund Spenser, no less. This is the tone of with these lamentations. Behold what reek, what ruin, and what waste, and how that she, that with her mighty power tamed all the world, hath tamed herself at last. The prey of time, which all things doth devour, that which is form doth flit and fall away, and that is flitting doth abide and stay. But already in the 1550s, Du Bellay noticed that Rome was already beginning to take on a new shape. Then also mark how Rome from day to day, repairing her decayed fashion, renews herself with buildings rich and gay, that one would judge the Roman demon doth yet himself with fatal hand and force again on foot to rear the powdered corpse. The powdered corpse is English, it's not quite so violent in French. But it certainly is true that the popes who had returned from exile had decided that Rome must again be a dominant city. Next two, please. And this one. These are the kind of images that went with that bewailing of the fate of Rome. This one comes from Siena, about 1410. This one is 50, but they both show you the river going through the city, the Vatican, St. Peter's and Hadrian's Mausoleum, the Pantheon, the Forum is about there, and you have the same images here, the Vatican, St. Peter's, the Pantheon, the Forum and the Colosseum in the background. They appear over and over again in very many contexts. But it's at this point that two elements enter into the story, which are in a way unrelated, but which hit the city, deform it, at the same time. Now, I can only really name them and refer to them very briefly. One is the devising perspective. Because once artists begin to look at the world through the perspective mesh, once the theater becomes the place where human action is seen against a perspective background, the city is also seen slightly differently. Now that informs the way in which the city is looked at and understood. And the other thing which influences its shape, its physical shape, is the arrival of artillery. Now, in fact, artillery had been about in the 15th century. Jan Žižka employed field artillery in the Hussite Wars in the 1420s. And large field guns were used in the siege of Constantinople in 1453, when the Turks finally took it. And these guns were so big and powerful that they were still being used in the 19th century. Now this meant that brick walls were not much use against artillery, certainly not stone ones. They fractured when hit by metal balls projected by gunpowder. And a new kind of defenses had to be devised, defenses made largely of earth and with bastions from which guns could be fired without interfering with the neighboring bastion. Let's have the next one there, please. Now, this is when a new kind of city rises, a city in which there is a central open space, and the ways out of it lead alternately to gates and to bastions. This is the city of Palma Nova, built by the Venetians as a bastion against the Turks. The central tower was never actually built, but you see the sort of completely new landscape this involves. Now, I'm showing on the other side an 18th century drawing of New Orleans, where you see in America a city fortified against the Indians, but like very many cities, within this kind of wall, you could also have an orthogonal city. So although this now arises as a new kind of form, the defenses also allow for the orthogonal city, for the grid plan, to be enclosed in the new kind of defenses. Now, I'm going to make a jump. Next two, please. I'm jumping to the second half of the 16th century, when Franciscan Friar Peretti became a cardinal. He took the title from his village, Montalto, and he had been very much favored by the Pope, who raised him to the purple. But then his successor didn't care for him, and cardinals received a pension from the Pope. And on visiting this villa, the Pope, who didn't like him, said, "If you can build a villa like that, you don't need a pension." So the pension was withdrawn, and he was on hard times. But this is the main house. And what he does are two things. He builds, this is on, this no longer exists, it's on the site where Rome Station now is. I'll show it to you again in a moment. He builds onto Piazza delle Terme a row of dwellings with shops underneath, ending in a little palace. And he does something else. He makes the sort of avenues that you had in the radially planned cities in his park. This is the villa. And he worked very closely with an architect called Domenico Fontana, who came from Como, like very many architects, and who charged him a very low fee when the pension was withdrawn. Next two, please. But Domenico Peretti was, in 1585, elected Pope, Sixtus the Fifth. This shows his coronation. And I'd like you to notice, this is, of course, the Dome of St. Peter's, which wasn't finished. You don't see it on this slide very clearly, but there's an obelisk here, that obelisk. And the Pope is being crowned there. These are wooden railings. The crowd is out here. The buildings are a bit of a mess. This is the old Constantinian Basilica. There's a 15th century porch. These are later buildings. He didn't like all this, and he determined to make order. Now, Sixtus was an extremely aggressive and highly organized man. The first thing he decided to do when he became Pope was to finish banditry. Anyone caught with armed assault was decapitated. No mercy was shown. He was extremely severe. But he was also very fair. That is, he didn't use this weapon to pursue any of his enemies. And in the 5 years of his papacy, banditry in Rome was finished. So it was a violent but effective method. He decided also that he was going to revamp Rome. And he was going to revamp Rome on new perspectival lines. Next one there, please. One of the first things was that Rome was going to be marked by definite high spots. One of the sort of markers that you wanted were obelisks. So this obelisk, sometimes known as the obelisk of Nero, which had the bronze ball on top, which was supposed to contain the ashes of Julius Caesar, but in fact turned out to be solid, had to be moved. Competition was declared. These are various projects for how to move the obelisk. And Fontana, lo and behold, won the competition with his project. Next one there, please. And in fact, the obelisk was moved without much of a hitch and very much on budget. This was something Sixtus was also extremely keen to save money. Next one there, please. Another one that was raised was the obelisk which Augustus had brought from Heliopolis to be the marker of a public sundial. Sundials were extremely important timepieces in Rome, and this was a huge sundial all over the Campus Martius, of which the remains of the floor are in the nearby church of San Lorenzo in Lucina. But the obelisk was put up again. It'd been smashed rather badly, as you see. Next one there, please. There you see how fragmented it is, an 18th century engraving. Next one there. He was also pretty ruthless about antiquities, I'm afraid. Next one there. Oh, there is Domenico Fontana with his pride, the obelisk which he had moved. This records his also he's being made a knight. He's wearing his knight's chain and sort of clasping the two together. Next one there, please. This column was moved from its place and put in front of Santa Maria Maggiore. So another not an obelisk, but a column. Santa Maria Maggiore was the church to which the Pope was very attached and in which he's in fact buried. Next one there, please. There's the column, and the next one here. This, a drawing by an antiquarian, Antonio Dozio, this is a septizonium, an antique structure which had, in fact, a small church inside it, which was regarded with great respect by antiquarians and by architects, but which was in the way, and Sixtus had pulled down. Next one there. But perhaps the biggest operation was the revamping of the baths of Diocletian. If you remember Diocletian, who'd moved to Split, he'd also built the last of the large baths in Rome, and when it had fallen on bad days, it became a church, Santa Maria degli Angeli. Next one there, please. And when the Roman monarchy took over Rome in 1870, it was put under an interdict and couldn't use the papal churches, so this in fact became the cathedral of the Italian monarchy. There it is, and there you will recognize the Villa Montalto with its diagonal avenues. There is Santa Maria Maggiore and the column in front of it. Next one there, please. So what you'll look, this is in fact that. You're looking at the tepidarium here, which is what you saw on the previous slide. And these two pavilions are, in fact, here and there. And the exedra, great exedra opposite the entrance to the tepidarium, is still part of the layout of the city. But it's here that Sixtus put on a huge enterprise. This is the Church of Santa Susanna, and this is his big fountain. This is where he brought a new aqueduct into Rome, the Acqua Felice, and he arranged all this of a huge public laundry. So although he was very ambitious and very much concerned with these visual aspects, he's also very much concerned with giving Rome its proper equipment, urban equipment. Now, the new roads, next on there, please. There he is with his architect, and the next one there. And you see here the way in which he worked over Constantinian Rome, reconnecting the basilicas and laying out the roads which would interconnect them. There is Santa Maria Maggiore. This is a new mesh of roads. These two roads of Santa Croce in Jerusalem to St. John Lateran. And by a cunning policy of tax remission and easy capitalization, he got traders to work to build the sort of building he had patronized himself on Piazza Termini, this building which I showed you in detail earlier. He made these streets into an extremely workable, and also by paving, extremely operative element in the city to which new building was attracted, and the sides of the city were built up so that the city grew within the mesh which he had provided. Now, what Sixtus had managed to do in Rome is to marry the perspectival city with a fortified city. I'm making a jump, but this now becomes the new way of operating in the urban environment, the only way in which the urban environment can be understood. Now, let's have the next two slides. That's the Exedra now with the Via Nazionale. And the next one there. Let's leave this one. When London burns down in 1666, of the plans which were proposed to the king to adopt the Sistine solution, they marry the grid. This is John Evelyn's plan, and this is Christopher Wren's plan. They marry grid with central plan and with the cross avenues of the kind that Sixtus had planned in Rome. And the next one there, please. And this becomes then the way in which landscapes are considered. The diagonal ways, the kind of diagonal planning which we associate with French parks, is in fact a reworking of the Sistine method within a landscape context. And I think you have to remember that Wren was very much aware of both Mrs. Marly, the subsidiary palace of Versailles. Wren was very much aware of the French park layouts of the time, as was Evelyn, who had also been to Rome. And the next one there, please. So that when, at the end of the 18th century, a new capital is planned for the United States, the first project by Thomas Jefferson is of a grid plan. Those of you who know Washington will know that Georgetown is there. You can just see. This is actually Thomas Jefferson's drawing for the plan, which laid out as a totally conventional grid. But this was not acceptable. Next one there, please. And a French officer, Major Nanfan was, this is not his drawing, but it's his project, was involved in producing a new scheme. Now, Nanfan was well aware of French pot layouts. He'd been brought up in Versailles. He may not have known of what Sixtus had done in Rome, but in fact, a Sistine city that he planned for the United States. It's a city in which there is an axial forum-like space which occupies the president's the president's residence and the main building, the curia, as it were, the Senate building, and between them, the two avenues constitute the basic orthogonal plan from which the grid is projected, but it's crisscrossed by the Sistine avenues which enliven the plan and which make Washington what it is, quite different from many, many other cities in the United States. Now, when L'Enfant laid this out, the city was a bit like the Rome of Sixtus V, a low-slung parkland city. It's now been entirely built up, as Rome has. And it is the way in which that is played out in the 20th century that I would like to consider next week. The way in which the role of the model and the function of the gridded island has provided us with the world city of our time. Thank you very much.